Hello. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 4th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Reverence for Creation, Genesis and Other People's Creation Stories, presented by Paul Harder. Disc number HAP 2005-03.
The ones on Genesis 1 and 2 as well? Okay. Yeah, Genesis 1 and 2. So, you know that Genesis 1 and 2 are the creation narratives from the Hebrew scriptures, which Christians also understand, because Christians understand Christ as the second Adam, or a renewal of creation. So we're going to go back with that in mind, with Genesis 1 and 2 in mind, and look at a couple of different creation stories. And I need a couple volunteers. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's see. I need a narrator. Who has a great voice for a narrator? Who has a big stentorian voice? Okay.
This is you. You hand it to me. I'll be half a day in the memory.
Okay.
All right.
Who is it? Okay.
You want me to?
Well, I'll
have
these out. I'll hand these out.
Can
then
you sit and relax a little?
Yes, of course you can. There's no pressure here whatsoever.
All right.
I need the first man, a nephew or a husband. Well, since you, that's you.
That's you. I'm walking around with you.
You walked in on cue. Okay, I'll explain this in a minute.
Am I in the research?
Yes, you are. Other people's creation narratives, or do you want to know how you raise your children?
Oh, I like this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So what am I going to read?
I need a great mother. All right. I need a voice of some children. Who can? Well, no.
Okay.
Those are the only speaking parts. Okay. For the rest of you, do you have a copy of this? Do the rest of you have a copy of this?
No.
Oh, okay. Pass this out. Just take one. Okay. So let me explain what this is. What you have in your hands is the Penobscot creation narrative. Penobscot. That's an Indian Native American group from the Northeast, associated with New York State. Before the Puritans came, before the United States came into being, before it was a colony of England, you all know, obviously, this North America was inhabited by many groups, tribes, ethnic groups, each who had their own common story. This is the Penobscot creation narrative. And it's short, and we're going to go through it and then talk about it. And for the first part, let me read it through. I'll read it through out loud, and then we'll do it according to parts. And each of you identify your parts. I've marked on some of your sheets each of the parts. So let me quickly read through this. When Klaus Kirby, the All-Maker, lived on Earth, there were no people yet. But one day, when the sun was high, a youth appeared and called him, "Uncle, brother of my mother." This young man was born from the foam of the waves, foam quickened by the wind and warmed by the sun. It was the motion of the wind, the moistness of water, and the sun's warmth which gave him life. Warmth above all, because warmth is life. And the young man lived with Klaus Kirby and became his chief helper. Now after these two powerful beings had created all manner of things, there came to them, as the sun was shining at high noon, a beautiful girl. She was born of the wonderful earth plant, and of the dew and of the warmth. Because a drop of dew fell on a leaf and was warmed by the sun, and the warming sun is life, this girl came into being, from the green living plant, from moisture and from warmth. "I am love," said the maiden. "I am a strength giver. I am the nourisher. I am the provider of men and animals. They all love me." Then Klaus Kirby thanked the great mystery above for having sent them the maiden. The great nephew married her, and the girl conceived and thus became first mother.
M. Klaus Kirby, the great uncle who teaches humans all they need to know, taught their children how to live. Then he went away to dwell in the north, from which he will return sometime when he is needed. Now the people increased and became numerous. They lived by hunting, and the more people there were, the less game they found. They were hunting it out, and as the animals decreased, starvation came upon the people. And First Mother pitied them. The little children came to First Mother and said, "We are hungry, feed us." But she had nothing to give them, and she wept. She told them, "Be patient, I will make some food. Then your little bellies will be full." But she kept weeping. Her husband asked, "How can I make you smile? How can I make you happy? There is only one thing that will stop my tears." "What is it?" asked her husband. "It is this. You must kill me." "I could never do that." "You must, or I will go on weeping and grieving forever." Then the husband traveled far to the end of the earth. To the north he went, to the great instructor, his uncle, Klaus Kirby. What he should do. "You must do what she wants. You must kill her," said Klaus Kirby. Then the young man went back to his home, and it was his turn to weep. But First Mother said, "Tomorrow at high noon you must do it. After you have killed me, let two of our sons take hold of my hair and drag my body over that empty patch of earth. Let them drag me back and forth over every part of the patch until all my flesh has been torn from my body. Afterwards, take my bones, gather them up, and bury them in the middle of this clearing. Then leave that place." She smiled and said, "Wait 7 moons and then come back, and you will find my flesh there. Flesh given out of love, and it will nourish and strengthen you forever and ever." So it was done. The husband slew his wife and her sons, praying, dragged her body to and fro as she had commanded until her flesh covered all the earth. Then she took up her bones and buried them in the middle of it. Weeping loudly, they went away. When the husband and his children and his children's children came back to the place after 7 moons had passed, they found the earth covered with tall green tasseled plants. The plant's fruit, corn, was First Mother's flesh, given so that the people might live and flourish. And they partook of First Mother's flesh and found it sweet beyond words. Following her instructions, they did not eat it all, but put many kernels back into the earth. In this way, her flesh and spirit renewed themselves every 7 months, generation after generation. And at the spot where they had burned First Mother's bones, there grew another plant, broad-leaved and fragrant. It was First Mother's breath, and they heard her spirit talking, "Burn this up and smoke it. It is sacred. It will clear your minds, help your prayers, and gladden your hearts." And First Mother's husband called the first plant Skarmunal, corn, and the second plant Utarmurwaya, tobacco. "Remember," he told the people, "and take good care of First Mother's flesh, because it is her goodness become substance. Take good care of her breath, because it is her love turned into smoke. Remember her and think of her whenever you eat, whenever you smoke the sacred plant, because she has given her life so that you might live. Yet she is not dead, she lives. In undying love, she renews herself again and again." That is, short and sweet, the Penobscot creation narrative. The Penobscot people lived in the area around New York State until they were basically pushed out and disintegrated under the impact of the growing American civilization. And that's it, that's what it is. Now, you heard it all, you have an impression about what it is, because I read it, so you have a sense of what it is. Let's look at it a little bit more closely. Let's go through it again. Someone has a copy called the narrator copy, you. And someone has a copy that's titled Klaus Kirby. That's the voice of the high god. Who has that?
The nephew husband.
Okay. You're the nephew husband, the nephew of Klaus Kirby, and the husband of the great mother. Who has Klaus Kirby? Did I get that? Is there one?
It's yours. I'll be Klaus Kirby.
Oh, okay.
I don't have anything that says that, Julie, but
I
have no problem.
Give one out to someone. And then who has the great mother copy?
I have it.
Okay, you have the great mother copy. And I need one up here, too. Oh, okay. Which one is this? Okay, well, I'll read the high god. Well, since I'm the leader of this session, I'll be the high god anyway. Why don't you begin and read it? Read it however you wish.
And you have underlined said the maiden.
Let me see.
What is that?
Oh, that means you remember to say that.
I remember to say that?
Well, when the maiden or the great mother says something, then you...
Oh, then I say, I get you, I get you.
Okay.
So, yeah. When Koskoby the All-Maker lived on Earth, there were no people yet. But one day, when the sun was high, a youth appeared and called him Uncle, brother of my mother. This young man was born from the foam of the waves, foam quickened by the wind and warmed by the sun. It was the motion of the wind, the moistness of water, and the sun's warmth which gave him life. Warmth above all, because warmth is life. And the young man lived with Koskoby and became his chief helper. Now after those two powerful beings had created all manner of things, there came to them, as the sun was shining high at noon, a beautiful girl. She was born of the wonderful earth plant, and of the dew, and of the warmth. Because a drop of dew fell on a leaf and was warmed by the sun, and the warming sun is life, this girl came into being from the green living plant, from moisture and from warmth.
I am love,
said the maiden.
I am a strength giver. I am a nourisher. I am the provider of men and animals. They all love me.
Then Koskoby thanked the great mystery above for having sent them the maiden. The youth, the great nephew, married her, and the girl conceived and thus became first mother. And Koskoby, the great uncle who teaches humans all they need to know, taught their children how to live. Then he went away to dwell in the north, from which he will return sometime when he is needed. Now the people increased and became numerous. They lived by hunting, and the more people there were, the less game they found. They were hunting it out, and the animals decreased. Starvation came upon the people, and first mother pitied them.
The little children came to first mother and said, "We are hungry, feed us," but she had nothing to give them. And she wept. She told them, "Be patient, I will make some food. Then your little bellies will be full."
But she kept weeping. Her husband asked,
"How can I make you smile? How can I make you happy?"
"There is only one thing that will stop my tears."
"What is it?"
asked her husband.
"It is this. You must kill me."
"I could never do that."
"You must, or I will go on weeping and grieving forever."
Then the husband traveled far, to the end of the earth. To the north he went to ask the great instructor, his uncle, Koskoby, what he should do.
"You must do what she wants. You must kill her,"
said Koskoby. Then the young man went back to his home, and it was his turn to weep. But first mother said,
"Tomorrow at high noon you must do it. After you have killed me, let two of our sons take hold of my hair and drag my body over that empty patch of earth. Let them drag me back and forth, over every part of the patch until all my flesh has been torn from my body. Afterwards, take my bones, gather them up, and bury them in the middle of this clearing. Then leave that place."
She smiled and said,
"Wait 7 moons, and then come back, and you will find my flesh there, flesh given out of love, and it will nourish and strengthen you forever and ever."
So it was done. The husband slew his wife and her son, praying, dragged her body to and from as she commanded, until her flesh covered all the earth. Then they took up her bones, buried them in the middle of it, weeping loudly as they went away. When the husband and his children and his children's children came back to that place after 7 moons had passed, they found the earth covered with tall, green, tasseled plants. The plant's fruit, corn, was first mother's flesh, given so the people might live and flourish. And they partook of first mother's flesh and found it sweet beyond words. Following her instructions, they did not eat all, but put many kernels back into the earth. In this way, her flesh and the spirit renewed themselves every 7 months, generation after generation. And at the spot where they had burned first mother's bones, there grew another plant, broad-leafed and fragrant. It was first mother's breath, and they heard her spirit talking.
Burn this up and smoke it. It is sacred. It will clear your minds, help your prayers, and gladden your hearts.
And First Mother's husband called the first plant Scarmuno corn, and the second plant Ultramure Waihia tobacco.
Remember,
he told the people,
and take good care of First Mother's flesh, because it is her goodness become substance. Take good care of her breath, because it is her love turned into smoke. Remember her, and think of her whenever you eat, whenever you smoke this sacred plant, because she has given her life so that you might live. Yet she is not dead, she lives. In undying love, she renews herself again and again.
Okay, we've read that twice now, and if you were a Penobscot Indian, a Native American of the Penobscot tribe, you would know this story backwards and forwards and backwards, because every day you eat corn, which is a staple food, and you trade tobacco, which is a commodity. That's what the first white people bought. It's one of the things that the first white people bought. Two most important things in the lives of the Penobscot Indians, corn and tobacco. What do you think of Klaus Kirby?
He's like God.
He's like God.
Mm-hmm.
How is he like God?
He has rules for happiness, happy living.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's all knowing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How else is Klaus Kirby like God?
Everyone went to him when they wanted to know what they're supposed to do.
Right. He did. They did. What were we going to say, Mary?
I was going to say he created the world.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know if someone else had said that.
No. It was very good. It said all maker.
But there's still the great mystery above.
A mystery above? Where do you see that?
Two paragraph. Klaus Kirby thanked the Greek mystery above.
Ah, very good.
So that's why I'm not quite sure of who Klaus Kirby is here.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you find that?
The first, second, third, fourth paragraph. Then Klaus Kirby thanked the great mystery above for having sent them the maiden.
Uh-huh.
Very good. So Klaus Kirby, even though he is the all-maker, the creator God, is still below someone in...
Seems like it. Or he's the earthly intermediary or something.
And I don't think he's all-knowing, because both the man and the woman appeared, which tends to indicate that he didn't know they were coming.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously he isn't all-knowing, mm-hmm. all-seeing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Would you worship Klaus Kirby if you were a Penobscot Indian? Maybe? Uh-huh.
Well, maybe the Greek mysteries. I don't know what other stories they have, if this is the only story in the world.
I would say more like revere rather than worship. Is there a difference between the two? But
at the second paragraph it says, now after these two powerful beings had created all manner of things, there came to them the beautiful girl.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So actually, Klaus Kirby and his chief helper created.
Right.
Yeah.
The nephew, or the guy who appeared in the scene and said, uncle.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And it doesn't indicate that he's still around, because it says when he lived on the earth.
That's right. Where did Klaus Kirby go?
To dwell in the north.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
I heard of my mother. So the Greek mystery about the mother.
Where are you reading it from?
Third sentence. And he came, or third line, uncle, brother of my mother.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he called Klaus Kirby. So obviously, there's something to find his mother, whether it's Mother Earth or the Greek mystery. I don't know. Probably Mother Earth.
And he teaches humans all they need to know.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a strong concept in here of male female, that a male god is not there without a female version. The mother of my father implies that there's a male-female relationship going on, mm-hmm. even above Pliskirti.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, I mean, what you've exactly pointed your finger on, the fact that in many creation narratives there's not a god who is doing everything. There is a community of a divine council, in a way. Who would you worship here? If you were a Penobscot Indian, you ate corn every day, you had a corn festival, you perhaps had a tobacco festival.
Just to worship First Mother.
First Mother? Good. Why would you do that?
In remembering her sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She gave her life for her people. Where have I heard that
before? You want the giving to continue.
You want
the bountiful harvest.
That's right. That's right.
So in some ways, as in other Native American cultures, mm-hmm. you also worship the earth, or you mm-hmm. keep the earth.
Mm-hmm. Keep your sacred, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Earth on sacred ground. Mm-hmm. On sacred ground, sort of a thing.
Exactly. Would you go so far as to say, I think you may have said it, would you go so far as to say you would worship the earth, or?
Yes. What I'm saying is that that's an underlying thing in Native American cultures.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, I'm not well versed on, mm-hmm. you know, world cultures, but there is a strong earth mm-hmm. Sacredness.
Mm-hmm. Sacredness of the earth, yeah. Mm. Why do you think that there is this sacredness of the earth from this text? What evidence from this creation story would you have that the earth is sacred?
Well, because First Mother gave her life,
mm-hmm.
and she was, instead of saying, being like a cannibal only eating her, why, she was asked to be returned to the earth,
mm-hmm.
and then she fertilized it, evidently.
Well, she was born of the wonderful earth.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Born.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the youth came out of the waves and the foam,
mm-hmm.
formed by the sun, so I don't know how the sun fits in here.
Yeah, it's sort of a constant, I suppose. Like the earth, you know, it seems like a constant. Now, if you were a Penobscot Indian, and you were to make up a prayer, say, if you were to pray to someone in this story, who would you pray to and why?
I keep going to the All-Maker.
Right, advice. Is that the same thing as praying to?
Not necessarily, but sometimes people look at it that way in terms of being as a consultant, as mm-hmm. someone to
mm-hmm.
talk to.
Mm-hmm.
Prayer is conversation.
Yes.
Yeah, and it says in the last paragraph, the First Mother's husband said, remember her and think of her whenever mm-hmm. you eat, whenever you smoke, because she has given life so that you need it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you were planting harvest, planting in the spring,
right.
You might pray to her,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, prayers of thanks and prayers of praise for, you know, with hope for a bountiful harvest.
Yes. Uh-huh. So harvest time, you would probably pray to the Great Mother, who's the source of...
Planting time.
Pretty much, you know, two-thirds of the year there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you think you'd do in the winter when there was it's all snow and it's desolate and there's nothing green, and you know that there's these rich images of the warmth is life, and out of the warmth and the dew on the plant came the mother. those are all very warm images. What do you think you'd do in the winter?
Pray for spring.
Pray for spring. Yeah. Pray for.
Well, I don't know how to say it.
Klosh
Kerba? Is that how you say it?
I have no clue.
Oh, okay.
Your guess is as good as mine.
It seems to me that if I was in real trouble, or whatever, I would pray to that, because it says, you'll return when needed.
Oh, very good.
That's right.
That's very good. Who went to him, or who prayed to him, or you might pray to him in a general sense of encountering Klaus Kirby?
Well, the father went. The husband traveled far
to the end of the.
Why did he go there?
Because he didn't want to kill his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Seems reasonable.
Yeah.
He's looking for some other advice.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Second opinion.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
More direction.
more direction. The nephew husband, is he a sympathetic figure for you? Sympathetic in the sense that you would look to him, if you were a Penobscot Indian, would you look to him for some sort of guidance? Or, yeah, for what?
He's the one who directed them to pray to the mother.
Oh, okay. Okay.
When you're eating or smoking.
Mm-hmm. Do you see him as a leader? Would you see him as a representative of, I mean, as a tribal leader in a way? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't pray to him.
Probably not.
Probably not. No. You think he represents sort of male leadership in a village, perhaps? It's like most towns have a mayor, but at the end of the day, most mayors are sort of powerless. To other factors.
Well, is there a prophet in this narrative? I guess I would ask that question.
Right. Good. A prophet being? How would you imagine a prophet to be?
Someone who counsels and who is a leader. Maybe has some sacred knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. That is a figure, a prophet-like figure, someone. That's why I say as a follower, someone who responds to other actions. Okay, say you're a Penobscot Indian. What sort of festivals would you have? I mean, because all human beings have festivals. I mean, there's work time and there's play time. We had last week here at the village, we had Jubilee, which was in the history of Israel, a time when people rested from their labors, laughed, played music, and did things that didn't normally happen. What sort of festival do you think would come from this story?
Festival of the seventh moon.
Oh, good, good. Mm-hmm. And what happens at the seventh moon?
They could eat.
They could eat. Harvest time. Yeah, harvest time. Yeah, good.
Maybe all winter they smoke tobacco, I don't know.
Now, what do you think an occasion, winter, they smoke it back. An occasion, say you're at this corn festival on the seventh month, and your kid says to you, Mom, this is so boring. Why do we have to do this every year? So what would you tell your kid?
To ensure the continuation of the corn cycle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You'll have good harvest and bountiful earth, and mm-hmm. corn will spring up again.
That will give you life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to give thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Probably have to go back and review the story.
There you go. You tell the story again. And that's precisely why this story, if you look in at the end of the story, there's this editorial comment retold from three 19th century sources, including Joseph Nicolar. Creation stories have hundreds of variants. You can see that in our Bible, the Christian Bible. We have Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. If you went to Terry Brenheim's sessions, he read them as one. But if you look in your Bible, you'll see that there'll be a footnote that says, here this is a different creation story. There's one that uses one word for God and one uses a different word for God. Creation stories get told and told and told. They become variants on themselves. So this story just happens to be short. I can imagine as someone mentioned here today, there probably are all sorts of stories about Klaus Kirby. What's he doing? Where did he come from? And who is this great mystery beyond, the great mystery above? I would imagine that there's also lots of stories that the Penobscot Indians told about these things. But because these are oral traditions that only happened to be written down in the 19th century, this is the only version that we have. Let's move to, in the words of Monty Python, now for something completely different. I want to move to a different part of the world. And this is the place that I've been doing research the last couple years. A country called Indonesia. And Indonesia is quite wide, from east to west, 2,000 some miles, which is like from Maine to Los Angeles. And up here in these mountains, maybe some of you attended one of my previous sessions, in the mountains of North Sumatra, there's an ethnic group of 9 million people called the Batak, B-A-T-A-K. And don't worry, I didn't hear about them until I was 30 years old, so it's nothing. But if you go to Starbucks and drink Sumatra coffee, you drink their coffee, okay? 5 million of them happen to be Lutherans, okay?
Wow.
So the largest Lutheran church in Asia is all these people sitting up in the mountains of North Sumatra around this area called Lake Toba. Lake Toba, that is the place where, if you're a Batak, God created humanity. All right, we're going to I'm going to talk about the Batak creation story in a minute. You can pass this around and have a quick look to see exactly where we're talking. Singapore is down here, and then you can just have a quick look yourself. Now we start off with the Penobscot creation narrative, just because it's very accessible, and you can take it home and read it yourself and think about. What it might have been like to be a Penobscot Indian who told these stories around the fire, and had great festivals at the corn harvest. Which I'm not a farmer. When do we harvest corn? Is it September usually?
In Washington, late August, September.
August, September.
Depends on where you are in the country.
Yeah. Right.
And you have different varieties of corn that. You can harvest at different times.
That's true.
You can plant them at different times.
Mm-hmm. So you can harvest them. Now we have short season and long season corn. I don't know what they have.
Yeah. Well,
if my husband was here, he could tell you for sure, but it's not my problem.
Well, corn is what's called a staple food, and you can do lots of things with it, but it's just a basic staple food. Like here at Holden, wheat, the grains of wheat, grain seems to be a staple food. Mm-hmm. We don't grow it, but we eat it every day, the bread. And all the grains that are served in the dining room. Now, the creation myth, or the creation narrative, I should say, in technical terms, myth is sometimes used as narrative. Myth does not mean false. Myth just means a rich symbolic narrative, like we just read. So the creation narrative of the Batak people is different from the Penobscot narrative, because the Batak people did not eat corn. But they have pretty much the same, as all creation narratives do, they're about the beginning of the world, the beginning of humanity. But it's more than that, and I put to you this morning that it's not only about beginnings, but it's about the way things are. Creation narratives explain who you are and why you are, and why the things around you are the way they are. So, for example, the corn business reflected not corn in the midst of history, but corn right now. Why, Mom, why do we have to have this boring corn festival every September? And then the mother says, well, let me tell you about Close Kirby. Or there would be someone who told the story as a village leader. Now, the Batak creation myth, like that one, has hundreds of different forms. But only in the 19th century did they begin to be recorded. They were written on bark books, which are pieces of the bamboo plant, which were tied together with string so that they would open accordion style. And they were written in a script in a way that only the shamans or the magical healers, would be a combination for us of a priest and a doctor, would be able to read them and tell about where the Batak people came from and why the people are who they are today. They told this story, and here it goes. Mulajadi Nabulon was like Close Kirby. Mulajadi Nabulon is the Batak word for the great beginner maker of beginnings. Literally, that's what it means in the Batak language, the great maker of beginning. And one day, the Mulajadi Nabulon lived in this place called Benua Ginjang, which was the high cosmos, The Batak people believe that there are three levels to everything that is. The high heaven, the middle earth, and then the underworld. So in this high heaven lived Mulajadi Nabulon with the daughter of one of his other gods who were there. And I won't talk about the other three gods who lived in the high cosmos, but they had a daughter. The daughter's name was Sideak Perujar, and there won't be a test on this later, believe me. So Sideak Perujar was a daughter of the gods, and one day she said, I'm bored. I want to see the rest of the cosmos.
I like the fact that God's children gets bored too. Yeah. It's not just us. Okay.
No, exactly. And I don't think they used the word bored, but it's something like, she said to the high god, I want to see the Middle Earth. So what she did was to make a little hole in the bottom of the high heaven and descend on a rope. Okay, so she gets down into Middle Earth and she finds water everywhere. Middle Earth, or the middle part of the cosmos where we now live, was covered with water. What's that remind you of?
In the beginning.
In the beginning, yeah. Formless void, water covered the earth. Okay. There's common elements in many different creation stories. Anyway, so this girl, Deak Perujar, descends and she finds all water. So she goes back up to the high god in the upper heaven and says, it's all water. I have no place to stand. Okay. And so the high god, Mulajadi Nabulon, gave her a little bit of earth. And so she takes this little bit of earth and puts it on the water and creates an island. If you look on that map, I don't know if you can see it, in the middle of Lake Toba, is there an island on that map?
Yes, there is.
There is. That is called Samosir Island. That is where the first human beings came. And there's a mountain there called Pusut Buhit, which is where the first human beings came to be. Because Dea Perujar, having made this little island, discovered two things. She was lonely, and that there was a dragon who lived underneath the sea, Nagapadoha. Nagapadoha is the name of the primordial dragon of the underworld. If the tsunami and earthquake would have happened 200 years ago, the Bataks would have said, Nagapadoha, the primordial serpent, has wagged its tail. Today they don't say that because they're Christians and they have scientific minds like us, and they would say, oh, the subduction zones shifted, causing movement of water and the tsunamis. So Deak Perujar had descended, made a little bit of earth, decided she was lonely, and also found the dragon. She went back up and got a sacred magical sword, which she beat off the dragon, and she subdued the dragon. He didn't die, but he's still there. And she was also sent another person, a man, and they conceived on this little square of earth, Samosir Island, the first Batak man. They call him Siraja Batak, the Batak king. He is the first Batak. And from this first Batak come 325 Bataks, other Bataks, each one with a different name. I'll read you the most important names here that they had.
What, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
But didn't he have a wife? I mean, how? Where did the wife come from?
Deak Perujar is the wife. Deak Perujar is the daughter of the high gods.
Okay.
And she came down, decided she was lonely, and she subdued the dragon. She went back upstairs, and they gave her a husband. And then they had this man called Siraja Batak, who was the first Batak, the Batak king.
The rest of the people came from the first woman and man.
Well, the Batak king came from the first woman, Deak Perujar, and then the first man who was also given from heaven. And it's unclear at this point. There's probably different creation variants of the creation story, where the rest of the world came from, you know, because so far they're on this island, but ultimately there's more than just the island.
Sure.
And so on. And so the first Batak king produces 325 clans, or 325 children, each of whom become a clan. And their names are famous. These are famous old Batak names. Pardede, Simatupang, Pangabean, Panjaitan, Lumban Tobing. So if you meet a Batak today, and you probably will because now there's four Batak Lutheran parishes in America, Los Angeles, Seattle, Denver, and New York, they all have these names. They're one of 325 clans. And for example, there's a student now studying at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota, a guy named Andar. It's a good Norwegian name. His last name is Lumban Tobing. That's one of the old clans who came from Deak Brujar and her husband living on Lake Samosir, who gave birth to the Batak king. So what this explains is why all Bataks come from these same clans. So if you're a Batak, you have one of these names. It's a bit like the old, like in Minnesota, if you come from Minnesota, I come from the Chicago area, but if you come from Minnesota, you know it's full of Rose and Erdahls and Ilvesakers and Preusses and so on and so on. There's these, it's not the same clan system, but you can imagine what it's like for the Bataks then, who have this clan system. That is in it, and unfortunately I don't have a short, sweet narrative like the Penobscot narrative to give you, just because there's hundreds, and none of them are in English. That's the problem. I've been studying these, and none of them have been translated into English. But their creation narrative, like the Penobscot narrative, explains why things are the way they are. And if you're a Batak, you're only allowed to marry people of certain other clans, because you, for a variety of reasons. Okay. Is there any questions? It's hard to get your mind around a creation
so
story.
So how does Batak Lutheranism fit in with that creation story in Genesis?
They follow the most important thing in Batak society is kinship. If you are, for example, your name is Pardede, or what's your last name?
Mathis.
Okay. Any Mathis from wherever in the world can come up to you and ask to stay in your house. And ask for support because you come from the same clan, and you know. And the first conversation you will have with, say someone comes to you and his name is Curtis Mathis. He comes to you and says, okay, where in the Mathis family tree do we meet up? And then you will say, my grandfather Mathis came from wherever. And he married someone called Anderson, and then this one and the other Mathis would say, my great-great-grandfather Mathis came from, where did the Mathis come from?
It's actually Germany, so it's not Curtis Mathis.
Oh, okay. Sorry. But the
Mathis.
Originally from Germany. Yeah. So you would, with this guy you don't know, who happens to be named Mathis, would trace it all the way back to Germany and find out which generation Mathis is first. And you would find out where exactly you connect. And then there would be an obligation, a kinship bond, and a kinship obligation to help each other. So if this Mathis comes to you and says, I've just been laid off, my wife has left me, you would be obligated to set him up in your home and find him a job and help him get on his feet again.
Does the kinship line go through the maternal line or the paternal line? Or do you get to claim both, which would mean give you a lot of variation of who you could call on? How does that work?
It's what anthropologists call patrilineal. It goes through the father's line, pretty much like in the U.S. as well. Our children have to take the father's name, even if the mother keeps her name. There's variations on this, but that's the old patrilineal system. Now it gets very complicated because you must, as a Mathis, and you married a woman from what was your well I should pick
Italian.
What's her last name is?
Vows.
Her maiden name was?
Vows.
Her maiden name is what?
Vows.
B-O-W-E-S.
Vows,
okay. You would be obligated also to the Vows clan because they were the clan who gave you your spouse. Now we say it's patrilineal, it's also patriarchal, and we're dealing with the sort of pre-modern, you know, gender roles here. But you would be obligated to the Vows clan as well, because they are the source of blessing for you, for your spouse. The Mathis people who you would be obligated to, now you're also obligated to the Vows clan. However, your mother, who I don't know her name, but that clan, the clan who from which your mother came would be a source of a blessing for you. You could go to them and ask anything because your mother came from that clan. It's a very complicated kinship system.
So you would have several layers of people you could call upon.
And to whom you are obligated as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah, are some of these one-way obligations? Because you're implying that I can
exactly.
go to...
Exactly. Exactly. They're all one-way. Some are obligations to you, and some are you can make to other people as well. For example, if you wanted to start up a business, you say, I need some startup capital, and you know that your mother's family has wealth in this one family. So you can go to them and say, look, I'm from this wife-giving clan. You must give me, or not you must, but please help me start up this business. And they would be obligated to do that. So it's a very intricate system of obligations, kinship obligations based on that. And it all goes back to these 325 clans who all came from the first Batak man on Samosir, which is where Tzidek Pruger came down to earth.
So with Batak's affected by the tsunami, so they had to call upon a lot of...
A good point, excellent point. And what happened was, after the tsunami, by chance I was called to do tsunami relief work for the Lutheran Church, and I found this to be the case everywhere. In Aceh, the province of Aceh is on the north part. Yeah. There were Bataks up there living in Aceh. And the orphans, there was about 45 orphan children, Bataks, who lost their parents. Just an incredibly sad situation. These 45 orphans all were placed with members of their own kin group, their clan. So if there was a kid named Mathis who was lost both of his parents, the church looked on their church roll and started making phone calls of all the Mathises and found the one that was closest to this Mathis orphan. And then they placed that Mathis orphan with the Mathis family that was closest. And a lot of tsunami reconstruction is based on that as well. Family helping family.
So basically it functions as a sense of social security.
Exactly.
A way to care for widows, orphans, tragically unemployed,
mm-hmm.
whatever. Cheaper than insurance.
And because the Bataks had a very diverse agricultural system, they grew everything, and they also involved in metalworking. In the modern terms, they were not like the Penobscot Indians, who were primarily based around the corn and tobacco. They had a variety of agricultural products, which brought them wealth. Today, kinship is the main engine that drives their understanding of who they are. In addition to the Christian faith. So,
how did the Christians, the Lutherans, start by the Christian church
What happened was the first missionary came, and obviously the Christian faith is based on the scriptures, which tell the story of God The God, the father of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, who was also the father of Jesus Christ. That whole creation narrative, if you will, was brought to North Sumatra by a missionary who saw that in the Old Testament, God is named differently. God is called by different names, Elohim, El Elyon, Yahweh. In fact, the revelation of the name of Yahweh is something that this missionary used in order to show that Mulajadi Nabulon was a name for the unnameable God who stands beyond all creation, who Jesus called Father, Abba. That is the same as the name Yahweh, which was given to Moses. That's a new name. You know, remember, Yahweh is a new name for God given to Moses on Sinai. Before that, there were different names. The missionary simply said that Mulajadi Nabulon is a name for the God of the Bible. But you didn't know that, or he didn't say you didn't know that, but he was able to persuade them that the God, the father of Abraham and Sarah, was also the God of the father of the Bataks. So in a way, the Bataks were reaffirmed in their creation narrative because it explained who they were. If your name is Pardede, Lumban Tobing, or Mathis, assuming you're a Batak, you knew who you were because of your own creation narrative, how you came into being. At the same time, you realized, they realized as Christians now, that the God, the Father of Jesus, is the God of all. So Mulajadi Nabulon is sort of a misnomer in a way.
I asked that because we've been traveling in Alaska,
mm-hmm.
and the Russian Orthodox Church, I believe, when they established missions in Alaska,
mm-hmm.
they discouraged, in fact, they kind of prohibited any ungodly or unchristian worship.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, to the point that all children were taken from their families and put in Indian missionary schools, which to me, you know, I think there's been some retribution for that.
Mm-hmm.
But it still pretty much destroyed
mm-hmm.
their own culture.
Their own culture, right.
I was at your first lecture,
mm-hmm.
it was very good, about how Christianity came. And you mentioned something that I was trying to get back, and that why they accepted Christianity over Muslims. And it was something about, I wrote this to somebody, the Muslims were non-peaceful. They were what?
Yeah, in the middle of the 19th century, there was a Muslim rebellion. I mean, if you think radical Islam is something that's new, it's not. There's always, uh-huh. at some points in history, small groups of radical Muslims who make war in order to Islamize certain territories.
Oh, they do.
And in the 1820s, yeah.
So, and that's what they did, and that's why they were turned off, so to speak,
right, they were
by the Muslim. I think that's a very important point.
Mm-hmm.
And that first lecture, I don't know if you're going to give that again. It's
mm-hmm.
very interesting.
Well, you brought up the point at which I would, the point that I really wanted to end with today, or we'll end with it together over the next few minutes. It is that most people today now have two creation narratives. The Bataks have two creation narratives, which they coordinate quite easily, because the creation narrative which I talked about, Deak Purujar coming down and forming the first Batak man, and then all these clans, that's something that is compatible with the worshiping the God of Abraham and Isaac and Sarah, the father of Jesus Christ. Because the people generally, we do as well, I don't know if this is new for you, but we have different creation narratives that explain different things. We have the story of Adam and Eve, which explains fault. Fault being the fallibility, which we all experience, and the fact that we say we're all sinners. Why? Well, Adam and Eve decided they wanted to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and be like God. What's that explain? Well, the basic human fault is pride. The basic human fault is one of wanting to be like God. That's just a truism, and that's why eventually God had to become incarnate and die in the form of Jesus Christ. However, we also have narratives that explain who we are. And I could ask you, and I should ask you, what sort of family traditions do you have that explain who you are? We have an American one that assuming we're all Americans, we live in this great experiment in democracy called the United States of America. All right, we're all part of this, and it looks like we're all immigrants at some point. We're all immigrants. We came from somewhere else because they were looking for a better place in order to make a life. That's a creation narrative, you know, that all of our blood doesn't come from North America. I mean, the blood that's in North America originally was Penobscot, Hopi, Navajo, Sioux, and our blood is immigrant blood, and that's a creation narrative in a way. It explains where we come from. Do you have any family traditions that explain who you are, like some...
Well, you know, you get the simple things, like lefse at Christmas.
Right.
And an immigrant is required of Christmas Eve in our family. You know.
In your family, right.
What is it?
Huh?
What did you say?
Immigrant, it's a Norwegian pudding.
Ah.
Basically, if you cook cream long enough, you take the butter off the top, then you have a pudding left, and then you pour butter back on top of it, eat it with cinnamon sugar, it's all cool. But
it's very rich, I think it's very good.
My family likes it a lot. Mm-hmm. It's a tradition I married into. I'm 100% American, and my husband is Norwegian. Mm-hmm. But is a requirement for Christmas Eve. I just do it with that.
And there's lefse making parties?
Oh, we have to have lefse. Uh-huh. That's required. I mean, mm-hmm. We had a very dear friend pass away recently, and she was a staunch Norwegian, and the first thing the reception coordinator did was call my husband, Pat, we need you to make lefse. You know, there wasn't even a, you know, mm-hmm. and there wasn't a doubt in his mind. He got out there, girl, did it. We don't usually have lefse this time of year. So we were all really happy about that, sort of.
What about, what towns do you live in? What festivals do your towns, if you come from a small town, I don't know, maybe you don't come from a small town. In Valparaiso, Indiana, where I live, we have the Popcorn Festival. Mm. Have you heard of the Valparaiso Popcorn Festival?
You raise lots of popcorn there, is that the reason?
Orville Redenbacher came from Valparaiso, Indiana. Didn't you know that? Didn't you know that? You didn't know that Orville Redenbacher came from Valparaiso, Indiana?
No, that's fine.
That's because that's my own creation story. Well, I grew up in Chicago. I didn't know about that until I moved to Valpo 5 years ago. I didn't know that. But now that I moved there, it's become my sort of creation story because what small towns do you guys, or what towns do you come from that have a festival?
I come from a small Northern California town mm-hmm. that was settled in 1847, mm-hmm. and a lot of ranching, farms, sheep ranches, mm-hmm. cattle. So of course every year they have rodeos mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. a number of the communities mm-hmm. to
now,
celebrate their traditions and
so do you have like rodeo days or something? Mm-hmm. So what's it called? Does it have a name? For marketing, for when tourists come?
Silver, I'll have to think about it. Silver Dollar.
Silver Dollar.
Silver Dollar Days.
And what time is that?
Well, I was born in Chico, California. And was settled very, very early by the Fremont mm-hmm. Party.
Now, to take this up to another notch, do you have any problems coordinating your Christian faith, assuming you're a Christian, with Silver Dollar Days?
No.
Okay. Do you see what I just did? I mean, there's two creation narratives that are happy to coincide. Any other town festivals? Yeah?
Coal Miners Days.
Oh. Where's that?
In Roslyn and in Clayton, mm-hmm. Washington.
Mm-hmm. It commemorates, what does it commemorate?
The miners and
Well, even the big cities, I come from Seattle, but they divide up into parishes, if you will. I mean, we have mm-hmm. Ballard Days, we have West Seattle Days, we have IU, we have them in the whole umbrella. It's called Sea Fair, so mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. a whole input.
we're only doing up the Rose Festival.
Right. Yeah, sure.
And we actually have a fellow city in.
So wherever you come from, there is local traditions that have perhaps festivals or commemorations or some local knowledge, as a famous anthropologist calls it, local knowledge, that talk about where you come from. And if you want, if you can't live without footnotes, there's a famous Christian theologian named Augustine who talked about this in terms of the two cities that everybody lives in, City of God and the City of Humanity. And it's exactly like whether you're a Penobscot Indian or a Batak in the middle of Sumatra, who's a Christian, you will always live in these two cities. So thank you very much.
Thank you.